You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 9th of February 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, we'll be in Islamabad with a look at the elections in Pakistan, which took place yesterday. Then...
Well, we were promised no NATO to the east, not an inch to the east, as we were told. And then what? They said, well, it's not enshrined on paper. So we'll expand.
Former Fox News host Tucker Carlson interviewed Vladimir Putin. We'll hear what the Russian president had to say in his first interview with Western media since the invasion of Ukraine. Then to South Africa, where Cyril Ramaphosa has given his State of the Nation address. We'll have a roundup of aviation news and a look at the design of the medals for the Paris 2024 Olympics. Plus...
We learned that not absolutely all US citizens are regarded by the Islamic Republic as foot soldiers of the Great Satan.
Andrew Muller gives us his take on the week. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. A bill worth just over $95 billion that includes aid for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan advanced in the US Senate yesterday after Republicans blocked compromise legislation that included a long-sought overhaul of immigration policy. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in an interview with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson that Russia has no interest in expanding its war in Ukraine to other countries such as Poland and Latvia. And President Volodymyr Zelensky replaced Ukraine's popular army chief with his ground forces commander yesterday. Do stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. Now, yesterday, Pakistan voted in the 12th general election since independence in 1947. During those 77 years, the military establishment has ruled for more than three decades and influenced and intervened in politics even when not directly in power. Pakistan's civilian political parties span a spectrum of ideologies in a nation of nearly 250 million people. This election took place against the backdrop of increased violence, state repression and a downward spiralling economy. Well, I'm joined now by Lynn O'Donnell, who's a columnist for Foreign Policy magazine. She's in Islamabad. Lynn, many thanks for coming on The Globalist. Why is what happens in Pakistan globally important?
Hi, Georgina. Thanks for having me. I think one of the main reasons that what happens in Pakistan is important to the rest of us is because of the security landscape. There is an underreported war going on in the mountainous regions of the northwest of the country, bordering Afghanistan, and an incendiary insurgency in Balochistan, which is a province of Pakistan bordering Iran. Just a couple of weeks ago, Pakistan and Iran traded missiles over the border in regard to insurgency groups in Balochistan. And the Taliban, which now controls Afghanistan, is waging war in the northwestern region, basically in an attempt to declare independence there and have a region from which to undermine, attack, destroy the Pakistani state. As well as that, Pakistan is very close to China, is rapidly becoming, I may say, a vassal state economically of China. It's also fairly tightly controlled by the military. So even though the country likes to call itself a democracy, it's essentially, as somebody described it to me yesterday, a security state. And that is something, put all of that together, I think it's something that we should be concerned with keeping an eye on.
Mm. Could you just outline the political landscape for us? Imran Khan, as we know, not standing, not allowed to stand, and that's a complete reversal from the last election.
Well, this is the merry-go-round of Pakistani politics since the country was established in 1947, as you said, almost half of the time since then has been under the control of the military. The rest of the time has been mostly in the hands of family dynasties, political dynasties, except for Imran Khan, who came to power as a candidate supported by the military. Once he was the prime minister, however, he turned on the military. Somebody here described it to me as power having gone to his head. He thought he was the one who had the power rather than being a figurehead of military control here. He turned on the military, which was something that was very welcome to Pakistani people, especially to young people. You have an incredibly young population here. 44% of the voters who are registered are aged between 18 and 35, and that's 44% of a total of 128 million people eligible to vote here. They're sick to death of power basically being handed around like a parcel at a party between the same old people who are in the thrall of the military. It looked like, and continues to look like, Imran Khan is the most popular political figure in the country. He was polling more than 50% popularity going into the election yesterday, even though, as you say, Georgina, he wasn't allowed to stand and he's in prison. So it's really the political landscape here is tortured, unstable, controlled by the military, and I think that that situation is likely to continue.
So can we just talk about how the state's been repressing political opposition? I mean, for instance, Imran Khan's symbol is a cricket bat that was not allowed to be on any of the polling papers.
Well, after he was arrested on corruption charges last year, the establishment, which is the word people use here for the military-civilian hybrid government, essentially went after his party, which is called the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, which is the PTI, basically. He was jailed so that he couldn't stand for election because convicted felons are not allowed to stand for office. So then the authorities went after PTI members, ultimately dismantling the infrastructure of the party so that people who had been members and had intended to stand for election had to stand as independents. But they wanted to hold on to that cricket bat symbol, which is important here because around about 50% of the population is illiterate. So they go into a polling booth and see the symbol of the person that they want to vote for. Imran Khan is a famous cricketer, and so the cricket bat is the perfect symbol for him. So they removed that, and so independent candidates across the country had to come up with their own symbols, you know, whether it was a pomegranate or an iron or a tree or whatever. So that made it a little bit more difficult for voters to identify the candidate that they really wanted to vote for. Added to that, the mobile phone network yesterday was shut down, so that that meant that people could not communicate, they couldn't join WhatsApp groups to find out where their polling booths were. And there has been, up in the lead up to that, a lot of AI-generated misinformation and disinformation going to people's phones, telling them to go to the wrong place or basically trying to undermine the PTI message and their standing in the polls.
So what are the results so far? Do we know?
It's trickling in very slowly. I think there had been an expectation that the counting would be completed by late last night, but it's not nearly completed. Hardly any results have been returned. The man who has been generally considered to be the military's candidate, Nawaz Sharif, he is expected to be named prime minister for the fourth time. He's leading very, very narrowly in his seat in the Punjab. The Punjab is essentially the Sharif dynasty's political hub. But so many people appear to have come out to vote for PTI / independent candidates that it's a very tight race. So I think there may be, and people I've spoken to today think that there is a lot of scrambling behind the scenes to alter the vote.
And what's most important to Pakistani voters?
Oh, the economy is in freefall, Georgina. Inflation is around 40%. There is incredibly high levels of unemployment. There aren't any prospects. People want to leave the country. Their rupees are worth less and less every day. It's being able to live and make ends meet that is really important for, let's face it, most people in the world. Here in the midst of an economic crisis that's not getting any better, people really want improvement to their standards of living. But I think that the turnout and the popularity, the turnout yesterday for the independents and for PTI, and the popularity of Imran Khan's party are an indication that people want a level playing field. They want honesty in politics. They want true representation. Whether or not that entails a revolution, as some academics and scholars here say, remains to be seen. But I think your general man on the street just wants a fair go.
Lynn, many thanks indeed. That was Lynn O'Donnell there. And this is The Globalist. Just coming up to 12 minutes past 10 in Moscow, that's 7:12 here in London, Vladimir Putin has given his first interview to a Western media figure since invading Ukraine. The Russian president chose to speak to Tucker Carlson, the former Fox News host, who's long been accused of echoing propaganda and misinformation on Ukraine and has questioned why the US should be spending billions to help the country defend itself. The interview was screened, apparently unedited, yesterday after Carlson had reportedly left Moscow. During his time in Russia, Carlson was accused of pushing falsehoods. Even the Kremlin said he was wrong to claim that no other Western journalist had even tried to interview Putin. So what was in the interview and what will the consequences be? Mark Galliotti, who's political analyst and author of Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine, watched it so you don't have to. Mark, many thanks for joining us. What were the main takeaways from this interview?
Well, I mean, slightly flippantly, the main takeaway is that Putin has not mastered the art of sound bites. In some ways, the real surprise about this interview was precisely that there were no surprises. We had all the familiar Putin tropes about how the Ukraine war was the West's fault, how Russia had a historical claim. I mean, we had a 30-minute diversion into the real weeds of Russo-Ukrainian history, or pseudo-historical, I should say. So, I mean, in some ways, it's very hard to pick a theme, because the honest answer is it's the usual stuff. The interesting thing is precisely that for once, he actually chose to present the usual stuff to a Western, I wouldn't really say journalist, let's say TV personality, rather than his usual stable of interviewers.
Yeah. I mean, aside from that half an hour long answer to the first question, he also then went on to say a lot about peace and how it had been scuppered, how Russia and Ukraine were ready to sign peace agreements.
Yes, and of course, this is where we actually had the claim that basically Boris Johnson torpedoed any chances for an early peace, which, again, interestingly sort of flatters Boris Johnson's standing, the suggestion that he could more or less tell Ukraine that no, it's not allowed to conclude a deal with Moscow, which clearly has been basically ruled out by both Kiev and London, as well as Boris Johnson himself. But again, it's this sort of recurring theme, which is essentially can be boiled down to it's not my fault. Everyone else is to blame. The revolution of dignity that took place in Ukraine in 2014, well, that was a CIA plot, he claims. The fact that, yes, the invasion, it was not an invasion. It was about protecting Russian security interests because of what the West was doing in Ukraine. And then, indeed, sort of the fact that the war is still rolling is because Boris Johnson somehow is meant to have derailed any peace talks. Time and time again, he talks about peace. He talks about how much he wants peace. But it's just the rest of the world, above all the West, are denying him that peace by essentially continuing to allow Ukraine to resist.
And he accused the CIA of blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline.
Yes, which is interesting, because in that respect, he missed a trick in that there's now, you know, quite a substantial body of opinion saying that, in fact, it was the Ukrainians who did so. But it just seems that, you know, he defaults time and time again to the CIA and, to a degree, Britain as the root of all evil.
Were there any hardball questions from Carlson, but for instance, on war crimes?
No, we didn't have war crimes as expected. I mean, look, the clear... The thing is that Carlson seems to know or care very little about Russia. There weren't really informed questions. The only point I would make is, again, contrary to expectations, he did ask about Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who's been arrested on some very, very dodgy seeming espionage charges. And, you know, people hadn't expected that. And Putin said that he wasn't going to free him, but nonetheless did actually hint that there could be a deal, a swap with a Russian contract killer who is currently sitting in a prison in Germany. That was the closest, frankly, we got to hardball questions, unless you accept that Tucker Carlson's questioning about whether or not Putin saw the workings of the supernatural in the world around him counts as hardball.
Has the timing of this been calculated to cause maximum damage to Ukraine, coming just as the House debated a spending bill?
Well, it's interesting because one has to think of this in terms of both what Russia gets out of this and, of course, what Tucker Carlson gets out of this. So I think from the Russians' point of view, yes, absolutely. This is the right timing because it continues the pressure on certain US Republicans to stymie the bill providing very substantial amounts of military and financial assistance to Ukraine. At the same time, obviously, from the point of view of the American elections, currently we're going through the US primaries. And this is an opportunity for Tucker Carlson to elevate himself within the Republican camp. We had questions, for example, about, you know, does Putin's experience of trying to negotiate with the Americans demonstrate really that the sort of the deep state is in charge and that elected politicians are having their wishes undermined by unelected officials? So again, this very much plays into the whole Trump agenda. So I think this is clearly a case of give and take, that both Carlson and the people he represents and Putin thought the timing was right.
I mean, who does he represent? What's his relationship with Donald Trump? And do you think that the former president was involved in this?
I would be very surprised if Trump were directly involved. If nothing else, he has too many court cases really to distract himself with other things. Look, I mean, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, Tucker Carlson clearly is setting himself up, because ever since he was sacked by Fox News, and to be regarded as beyond the pale by Fox News says something in and of itself. But, you know, ever since then, he's been setting himself up really, I would say, as an independent power broker of sorts within Republican politics. So I think in part this is clearly supporting an agenda and thus a candidate that he supports in the Republican primaries. But it's also demonstrating how powerful and how useful he can be. And it's worth saying, after all, that the massive furore around this interview has brought Tucker Carlson's name to places and to people that in the past he never would have. So he is going to do very well precisely out of the controversy around this interview.
And was it available to watch in Russia?
Yes, it's out in Russia, undubbed, and, you know, we're told at least unedited. Whether that many Russians are going to sit down for 2 hours the way I had to and actually watch what is, as I said, it has to be said, an astonishingly tedious interview. But nonetheless, yeah, it's there. But then again, there's nothing that Putin said, or indeed that Tucker Carlson said, that I think the Kremlin would worry about Russian citizens hearing.
And so how did Putin come out of it? If you're not a MAGA cap-wearing, frothing, mad person, will Americans be convinced that he's the wrong party in this, the wronged party in this war?
I mean, again, look, I think it's worth saying that I think it's unlikely that many people will, through choice, sit through this whole thing. What they're going to see is a curated series of clips shared on social media or on news programs or the like. And I mean, the thing is that when you don't actually see the full 20-minute sort of answer to a question, but instead a 20-second curated element, what you see is a person who seems fairly confident and competent. A few times he said, I don't remember the exact date or whatever, but certainly in comparison with how at the moment Joe Biden is being presented, such as in the recent report from a special counsel that sort of noted that he sort of basically clearly had certainly memory issues. You know, certainly the idea that this is essentially a competent chief executive will come across and will almost certainly be used to contrast with Joe Biden.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. That's Mark Galeotti there. Now, still to come on the programme.
We learned that not absolutely all US citizens are regarded by the Islamic Republic as foot soldiers of the Great Satan.
And we'll also be heading to South Africa, checking in on aviation news and asking how Paris is using bits of the Eiffel Tower for Olympic medals. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's 7:21 here in London. You're listening to The Globalist with me, Georgina Godwin, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Manveen Rana, who's a journalist and host of Stories of Our Times at The Times and The Sunday Times. Good morning to you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Delighted to be here.
As we were just hearing from Mark Galeotti, Biden's memory has become a front page issue.
Literally a front page issue. It's on the front pages of several of the papers this morning, The Telegraph, The Times. And it's very hard to have a good reading of this. You know, they point out this, you know, it's now been found that he couldn't remember when he was vice president. He couldn't remember when his son died. And rather unfortunately, when he came out in response to this special counsel's report last night, in order to defend himself, in order to point out that, you know, he has been president, he has been running the country, look what he's managed to achieve, he managed to make yet another gaffe by calling Egypt Mexico when talking about Sisi, when he was asked a question about the Middle East. And that follows on from a week of these sort of great memory slips. You know, he talked about Macron but called him Mitterrand. He was trying to talk about Merkel but described her as Kohl. And you just get this sort of sense, as you do with people of an age sometimes, of, you know, he is living almost in a slightly different era.
And, I mean, what then happens from here on?
Well, that's the question. You know, we are into an election year. Things are getting desperate. It's very late in the day for the Democrats to be working out who on earth takes over. You know, I think the Times this morning sort of points out when he came out to do this sort of response to the special counsel, they half wondered if it was an LBJ moment. If this would be the moment he says, actually, I can't possibly stand. He's already had to pull out of what should be a prime bit of free publicity. So in the run-up to the Super Bowl on Sunday, you know, they invite the president on to come and do an interview in the warm-up stage. It's a great bit of good PR, and he refused to do it because there's just a sense that they're worried about what he might say. How on earth do you go around the country campaigning when you can't be trusted to do the most, you know, the easiest of interviews?
And, of course, the question then remains, who would it be if not Biden?
Well, that is the question. And, you know, a lot of people would point out he hasn't been very good at encouraging, you know, figures underneath him within the Democrat Party. In a way, he had one job, I suppose, which was to sort of pass on the baton. He hasn't really allowed anybody to flourish. His vice president is never seen. There are no other sort of, you know, characters he's sort of brought along who've been, you know, people he's sort of invested in showing the public here, you know, here is a great person who might take on the torch. But there's no sense of, you know, who that might be. Mm. There's a bit of gossip in America, I think, that, you know, maybe Gavin Newsom, in an ideal world, maybe Michelle Obama will step up and join his ticket, and that will be something that, you know, that might be a winning combination that beats Trump. But at the moment, there is no sign of any of that on the horizon. Just a man who seems to be having a lot of terrible memory slips.
Big change of personnel, though, in Ukraine.
Yes.
Let's have a look at this story, which again is making front pages around the world. Zelensky has dropped his most senior general, a man who was very popular.
Hugely popular, more popular than Zelensky in Ukraine. And perhaps even more importantly, this is across the country. In all polls, Zelensky, his most senior general, comes up as being more popular than Zelensky. But when you go to the front line in particular, you know, you start to sort of see these great sort of paintings and graffiti, pictures of Zelensky's face. He's the most trusted. You know, the people who are actually risking their lives on a day-to-day basis, they look up to Zelensky, and this is now a man who's been taken away. There's also quite a lot of coverage talking about his replacement, which has been announced. So this is General Sirsky. And, you know, he has a lot of experience. He's been in charge of a lot of the army ever since 2014. He's been talking to NATO since then. But he was the man responsible for the operation in Bakhmut, which, you know, became this sort of town that was just rubble. And they lost a lot of their most highly trained fighters over this. So, you know, they're now into the point where they're mobilising, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, anyone who is of the right age is having to join up. But the people who were really skilled were sort of slightly lost and slaughtered on a battlefield which a lot of people thought they should have given up much sooner. And he was absolutely committed. He's very stubborn. He's not very good at sort of working out what is a strategic loss and what might be, you know, you might be better off letting the Russians have that and moving on somewhere else rather than losing more lives over it. So there has been criticism of him already. And there is a sense that, you know, this could be the moment Zelensky loses the war.
Well, Zelensky said that urgent changes are needed to ensure victory. But has he really justified getting rid of Zelensky?
I don't think he has, in a way that anybody's convinced by. Some of the papers, I think the Times this morning sort of carries a dispatch from the Donbass. I don't think the fighters there seem very convinced by the idea that Zelensky has to go. All of this seems to have come from a huge argument between them about where the war is at. So Zelensky published a paper in The Economist, actually, a few months ago, pointing out that, you know, they had reached a stalemate. That's not a word Zelensky likes to use. You know, he still wants to be talking about victory, all-out victory, a more maximalist view of what they can achieve. And there's a real row over a mobilisation bill in Ukraine. So Zelensky sort of points out that they're not only running out of weapons and aid, they're running out of men. They're literally running out of people to fight this war. And they need to sort of reduce the age that they start recruiting. They need another 500,000 men sent to the front. Zelensky thinks this would be hugely unpopular politically. He's very reluctant to do it. There's been a huge internal wrangle over this. The bill hasn't passed yet. And there's a sense now that Zelensky has brought in a general who's just very loyal to him, who won't question his policies and won't push for this.
Let's turn our gaze to here, to Britain and the Labour Party, which is widely seen as the government in waiting. But they've now scrapped a green pledge they made of £28 billion. It's going to be about half.
Yes. Now, this is sort of like, this is an interesting story. It's sort of day two of coverage. You know, we sort of had a sense yesterday in the papers that this was coming. Keir Starmer stood up and made the announcement yesterday. And this is sort of everybody taking in their response to it. And you can really tell it's an election year. So the front page of the Daily Mail writes, "How can you ever believe a word Sir U-turn says?" Making it quite clear where they stand on this, which I thought was very ironic, actually. I mean, I can only imagine that their editorial staff has a memory span about the same as President Biden's, because just 2 days ago, they were writing Rishi Sunak's, not U-turn, but watering down of net zero targets had spared the UK from riots. So as far as the policy is concerned, this is actually something they agree with. But rather than saying that, they're calling him Sir U-turn, which will probably stick. What I thought was most interesting, actually, was the coverage in The Guardian, because, you know, if the Daily Mail and The Telegraph are obviously the political home of the right, The Guardian should be Keir Starmer's greatest cheerleaders. But actually, they've come out saying fury as Starmer stages U-turn, and you know, they're voicing the part of the left. And, you know, they talk about the unions, in particular environmental groups, who are furious about this and see it as sort of a lack of commitment to the targets, but also sort of almost as the Labour Party reintroducing austerity, which you can tell is going to become a real point of tension in the run-up to the election. And then the Times has done a great colour piece where they sort of go into the characters and the arguments that led to this announcement. So, you know, given that, as you say, this is probably the government in waiting, you start to get a sense of the characters in there and who, where the tensions might lie. You know, we're not paying enough attention to that at the moment. We see them so much in the Tory party. We're still covering an awful lot of that. And suddenly you start to see where the characters sort of disagree. You know, there's real tension between Ed Miliband, who introduced this, and Rachel Reeves, who's all about the money and looking like they are sort of going to be a competent, fiscally responsible government. And they've got some great little quotes from sort of Labour backbenchers or you know, people in the party sort of saying, one of the rules of Keir's leadership is that he tends to get to the right place inelegantly. I think that's rather damning. Another sort of saying, the albatross around our neck was never the £28 billion figure. It was the lack of decisive decision making. So there is a sense that nobody's pleased with the way this has happened.
Yeah. Right, let's now talk about the one where Rachel forgets who Ross is.
I love this. I mean, so the Super Bowl on Sunday, the ads are always, they are eagerly awaited. It's like bigger than movies, really, aren't they? Everyone wants to know what the big ad is going to be. And this one is for Uber Eats. It's already been sort of, it's already out there. You can see it now. And the concept seems to be that you must remember Uber Eats does lots of other things now. It does flowers, it does stationery. But in order to remember that, you've got to forget one fact that's already embedded in your mind. That's their theory. That's the premise for this entire ad. And it includes David and Victoria Beckham having a long conversation trying to remember which band she was in. Painful. You know, was it the Cinnamon Girls? Was it Paprika? Well, you know, it's awful. It's genuinely quite cringy. And then there's a moment where Jennifer Aniston comes across David Schwimmer and just can't remember who Ross is. That part is actually very funny. But the bit that's caused controversy is a man staring at a giant peanut butter jar and sort of taking a spoon out of it and saying, this contains peanuts? So clearly he is somebody who has a peanut allergy, who not only forgot that fact or forgot that peanut butter contained peanuts, but wasn't bright enough to read the label. So there's been a real sort of a bit of anger that that's slightly irresponsible. It's a very serious matter. It does kill people. I mean, I am a peanuts allergy sufferer. And to be honest, I'm just delighted people know about it now. You know, growing up, it was always one of those things that nobody quite understood. So I don't mind the fact that it's being talked about, but it's not a particularly funny bit of the ad. I think they could lose it.
But, I mean, peanut allergy sufferers are outraged.
Outraged.
They're wanting it re-edited. They're wanting it removed.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest,
what's wrong with you people?
I mean, I won't lie. It is about two frames, and they could lose it, and it would actually make the thing funnier. You know, there is a very funny bit with another guy sort of standing in front of a mirror who's heavily tattooed going, why did I doodle on my face? So, you know, like, there are funnier parts of the ad. I don't think the peanut butter, I didn't think the joke worked so well. Controversially, I'm sure it was sort of, they spent an absolute fortune on doing it, and an advertising agency has told them it's the funniest thing ever. It's not brilliant, and there is now this outrage, and so it'll become very controversial too. They should probably just scrap that bit.
Whole Super Bowl, I mean, the conspiracy theories, the Taylor Swift,
I
mean, it's all just
Biden not turning up, yeah. Taylor Swift being there as sort of a CIA implant.
Quite extraordinary. Manveen, thank you very much indeed for coming on. That's Manveen Rana there. Now, here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. A bill worth just over $95 billion that includes aid for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan advanced in the US Senate yesterday after Republicans blocked compromise legislation that included a long-sought overhaul of immigration policy. 17 Republicans voted in favour in a surprising shift after they blocked the broader bill on Wednesday. Russian President Vladimir Putin said in an interview with former Fox News host Tucker Carlson that aired last night that Russia will fight for its interests to the end, but has no interest in expanding its war in Ukraine to other countries such as Poland and Latvia. He also said he believes it's possible to reach a deal to free the US journalist Evan Gerskovich. And President Volodymyr Zelensky replaced Ukraine's popular army chief with his ground forces commander yesterday, a huge gamble at a time when Russian forces are gaining the upper hand. The shake-up ushering in a new military leadership follows months of speculation about a rift between Zelensky and the army chief General Valery Zalushny, whom many Ukrainians see as a national hero. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. It is 9:34 in Johannesburg. That's 8:34 in Zurich. South Africa must go to the polls sometime between May and August this year. But unless there are major changes before then, the election will come at a time when the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, has never been so unpopular. For the first time since coming to power at the end of apartheid in 1994, the party of Nelson Mandela is facing the possibility of losing its parliamentary majority. The current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, attempted to rally support in his State of the Nation speech last night. Mabisa Makunga is editor of The Sowetan, a national daily publication in Johannesburg, and was monitoring the speech. Mabisa, many thanks for joining us. Let's first examine the content of what Ramaphosa said. Was there anything startling?
Good morning, Georgina. Thanks for having me. No, actually, it was quite expected. Important to note is obviously South Africa's democracy turns 30 this year. And so what the president did, which we did expect him to, was to really take us, you know, along a 30-year journey of the ANC in power. And he was very much emphasizing, you know, kind of the transformational policies and transformational journey that, you know, the ANC has taken South Africa and the impact of that on ordinary South Africans. He made an example, for example, of a fictional character, you know, who is a young woman who would have been born 30 years ago and really benefited, you know, as she grew up, benefited from, you know, from schooling, from health, from, you know, perhaps, you know, transformative policies as far as getting a job. And really telling that story, which I want to note is a real story. You know, many of us have benefited, you know, in terms of transformation from the ANC's policies. But the important thing, I think, which is what really South Africa is talking about, you know, right now, is the fact that that's half the story. In fact, a majority of, you know, 30-year-olds in South Africa right now are likely to be unemployed. Some possibly have not finished schooling. You know, really battling a poor and a struggling economy. So the debate now is, well, the president, you told us of this, you know, this good story of the last 30 years, but where are we now? And what does it mean now for an average 30-year-old and older, you know, of South Africa, when many people are actually unemployed and really battling?
Mm. Now, last year, the speech was disrupted by the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF. That's the leftist opposition party led by Julius Malema. They rushed the stage and they were temporarily barred from the legislature. This year, they boycotted the speech. Was there any raucous behaviour?
No, there wasn't, and I think, look, this year they did boycott after they were told not to come. So they were told not to come because this is effectively a penalty that was imposed on them based on their behavior last year, right? And then they took it to court, and obviously, you know, the court threw it out and said, no, well, you did not follow the rules of parliament, and therefore the penalty actually stands, the sanction stands. And so then they decided, okay, well, we're just going to boycott the speech and not come altogether. So no, it was actually quite smooth just as far as, you know, the proceedings of the day, yeah.
Mm. And just looking at the ANC itself, I mean, it does seem to be in disarray. At the end of last month, they suspended the membership of the former president, Jacob Zuma, after he announced that he'd vote for another party, MK, in this year's general election. What's the story behind that?
So Jacob Zuma has, I mean, you know, he was fired by the ANC. He didn't finish his term. So he's really been, you know, a better man since then. And increasingly so. And we know, you know, at some point he was taken to jail for failing to adhere to a Concord ruling. So many, many issues around him have happened. And he then decided in December last year, you know, to join a new formation called, you know, MK. And he said publicly that he would support that party and not vote for the ANC. And he phrases it and says the ANC of Ramaphosa. And the ANC really, what they've done, and which is, you know, vintage ANC, they've rallied together and really, you know, against what he is in his onslaught against them. And yes, so you've got a situation where you've got the former president of the ANC, a hugely popular figure in at least one part of the country, saying, you know, I'm supporting a different political party rather than the one that has failed you, notwithstanding the fact that he led it for 9 years. And now, you know, the ANC is kind of rallying together and saying, well, we need to fight. I mean, you could hear even in the tone of the speech of the president last night, he was quite critical, even though he didn't name him by name. but he was quite critical of, you know, the Jacob Zuma's presidency. And what he tried to do was to say, well, since he came into power 2018, he's been really trying to unravel and sort out all the mess. It remains to be seen. South Africa is probably in a much more difficult situation now, you know, with everything that has happened in the last 5 years. But nonetheless, you know, the story of Jacob Zuma is he has been, you know, suspended. He's pretty much, you know, on his way out as far as the ANC is concerned. He is an enemy of the ANC now, and that's how the ANC regards him.
But as you say, still hugely popular in his own state, KwaZulu-Natal. Let's have a look at those popularity figures, because the ANC and Ramaphosa personally really do seem to be in decline. Tell us more about where the various parties stand.
So the ANC, you know, the expectation for many people in some polls, you know, do put it under 1%. Sorry, under 50%, right? For this coming election, obviously it remains to be seen, but that's what the prediction of many polls are, including the ANC's own polls. But you know, then you've got the Democratic Alliance, you know, and the EFF, which is the third biggest party, and then you've got a range of many other smaller parties. So, and what is likely to happen, even if the ANC does fall, you know, under 50%, it is likely to still get the majority of the vote, enough to be able to form a coalition government. The question then that many South Africans and the ANC are grappling with is that if the ANC does form a coalition government, who does it form it with? Mm. Does it form it with the second biggest party, which is the Democratic Alliance? You know, and of course, you know, with the state of the Democratic Alliance and its own policies now, there's questions about whether or not that will happen. Does it form it with the EFF, which you say is kind of, you know, quite leftist? And many people saying probably that is likely. But I think, you know, from now until, you know, the elections, I think those are conversations happening publicly. Of course, ANC leaders will tell you that there's no way they're going to lose majority, even though they've become increasingly unpopular.
Nwabisa, many thanks indeed. That's Nwabisa Makunga there. This is Monocle Radio. Well, it's time now for a look back at the week that was with Monocle's Andrew Muller.
We learned this week that the United Kingdom is to be blessed with its very own equivalent of America's Conservative Political Action Conference, that annual Yahoo rodeo which usually tees up a pretty easy week for compilers of satirical news reviews sometime around the end of February.
Hooray.
So we have that to look forward to.
Yay.
Ooh. Yay.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yay.
Oh my God.
Hallelujah. What a result.
We learned that it appears that the beginning of February, and let's face it, we in the Northern Hemisphere need all the cheering up we can get in this of all months, will henceforth be enlivened by a wingding convened by optimistically entitled new Tory faction, Popular Conservatism, known to its friends and deriders as PopCon. On the one hand, that is, strictly speaking, an erroneous sound effect, it being PopCon, not popcorn. But on the other hand, we learned that PopCon was going to feel like an appropriate accompaniment to PopCon, which put on quite a show, little of it intentional. But we learned that there is actually an audience, other than the audience tuning in for ironic amusement, for this stuff. We learned from one of the stars of the show, the United Kingdom's seventh best 21st century Prime Minister, that
Britain is full of secret conservatives. People who agree with us but don't want to admit it because they think it's not acceptable in their place of work, it's not acceptable at their school.
They also appear to be struggling in large numbers to admit it to opinion pollsters' mind. We also learned from Liz Truss's oration, though cannot say we were surprised, that it turns out that absolutely nothing that is presently wrong with the United Kingdom is in any measure the fault of the people who have been governing it for 14 years. No, absolutely everything is entirely the fault of the left. So we learned that the UK's media and corporations are left-wing, which is an interpretation. We also learned from the same rousing Jeremiad that other key plotters in this vast socialist conspiracy include
with the Environment Agency, it's true with Natural England, it's true with the Office of Budget Responsibility, it's true with the Post Office.
Although if the post office actually are involved in the delivery of the woke subversion of Britain feared by Truss and her fellow travellers, it won't happen until 2038, and when it does, it'll happen in Spain. And we learned that one of the movement's other prominent intellectual engines, the actual MP Lee Anderson, that fossil fuels are clean energy, because...
And they say this, these wood pellets are sustainable because the trees, we can grow them again. Now, I'm pretty sure that coal, 100 million years ago, was trees and plants. Is that right, Jacob? It was. So I would argue that that's sustainable.
And tragically, that laughter did appear to be more of the with than the at variety. On the world, as opposed to the popcorn stage... We learned, heartwarmingly, in these more difficult-than-usual times for American-Iranian relations, that not absolutely all US citizens are regarded by the Islamic Republic as foot soldiers of the Great Satan. We learned that Iran had issued both a visa and a welcome to American actress Whitney Wright, who you may recall from, among many, many other broadly similar productions, lesbian news anchors, Who's Banging the Babysitter, and Cheer Squad Sleepovers 22, which, to be honest, we couldn't really follow, having not seen the previous 21. We never learned quite why Wright had chosen Iran of all places for an outing, but we did learn from her Instagram happy snaps that she can dress demurely when necessary, like when modest attire for women is enforced by the threat of violence from grown adult men who have chosen a job in which they are paid by the state to pester women about what they are wearing. We learned that Iran was, like many who have become acquainted with Whitney Wright's cinematic oeuvre, feigning outraged innocence, claiming that when her visa was issued, the foreign ministry had not been, quote, aware of the nature of her immoral and obscene occupation. So we appear to have learned the diplomatic equivalent of, I clicked on a link by accident.
Oh no.
Still, in what has been quite a week, four visits across the geostrategic front lines by American media performers, known for a willingness to do almost athletically submissive things for money, at least they didn't get lumbered with Tucker Carlson. And we learned that the long winter evenings do not exactly whiz by in the German settlement of Halberstadt. We learned that a decentish crowd had pitched up at Halberstadt's Bacardi Church to hear this. Which was an organ changing chords for the first time in exactly 2 years.
What?
What?
What's
the point?
Why would you do that?
We couldn't find that much verite audio of the actual event, so let's just have a single organ chord under the rest of this monologue. These peasants will never notice the difference. Oh, I've read that out loud, haven't I? We learned, or really reminded ourselves, as we may have caned this before, that this was the latest modulation in the ongoing performance of John Cage's piece As Slow As Possible, which began in 2001 and is scheduled to conclude 616 years hence in 2640, though we can recall going to a Morrissey show sometime in the late 1990s, which seemed longer than that. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
Many thanks to Andrew. This is The Globalist on Monocle Radio. Now, I'm very pleased to welcome to the studio Sally Geffen, who is an aviation analyst. Good morning to you, Sally.
Morning.
Let's start by looking at Boeing. They're under so much pressure amid the string of safety and quality control issues. We've just seen a preliminary report come out from the Transportation Safety Board. This is about this panel blowing off the Alaska Airlines plane.
Yes, this concerns the plug door, if you recall, a few weeks ago, dramatically and catastrophically flew off in flight. It's not a regular door or even an emergency exit. It's very discreet and you wouldn't be able to see it from inside the actual aircraft. It came loose. It flew off at 16,000 feet. And miraculously, nobody was seriously injured or worse, any fatalities. But as a result of that, this airplane type, the Boeing 737 MAX 9, was grounded, which affected two carriers in particular in the United States, Alaska Air and also United. And now huge questions have been asked, and there's congressional hearings into it, and there are investigations by the Federal Aviation Administration, which is the aviation regulator in the United States. And then just this week, we've had a preliminary report from the National Transportation Safety Board, which has found some very concerning matters already into how and why this accident ever occurred.
How damaging is this for Boeing?
It's extremely damaging. And what's more unsettling is that Boeing's been here before, in the sense that before the pandemic, there were two catastrophic fatal accidents with the same airplane type, a different version of this airplane type. And at that time, Boeing came under fierce scrutiny, and that airplane type was also grounded. And here we are 4 years down the line, and basically we're hearing the same mutterings, murmurings, criticisms, the same concerns about quality control and safety issues at Boeing, and what are the next steps. We've seen some of the chiefs of these companies change in that time, but it does seem to be rinse and repeat for Boeing. The Boeing 737 MAX was re-engineered after those fatal crashes, so those concerns were dealt with. However, why is it that bolts were missing on that door? That's why it flew off. That's why what the NTSB found. And, you know, what is really going on the shop floor, on the assembly line at Boeing, for this ever to have happened in the first place?
Now, I love Helsinki, but I fear I may never go to Finland again. And this is because Finnair is weighing its passengers.
Well, OK, let's put a bit of context to this, right? Yes, you know, fat shaming Finnair does make for a good headline. And it could actually massively rebound on Finnair simply from the optics of, you know, that thought that you might be weighed. First of all, it's just a short-term thing at the moment, running until May, and it's optional, so it's voluntary. They've been looking for volunteers who don't mind, with their cabin baggage, I should say, as well, standing on the weighing scales. I think it started with the CEO of the airline to show willing. This is in the interests of safety, ultimately, because it's about load control and working out the safe loads on the aircraft, because each aircraft has... Right. A maximum takeoff weight. So, yeah, people are putting themselves forward. There is a wider concern about, you know, there are standard weights used by airlines to work out the passenger loads on any aircraft, but those weights have increased over the last 10 years. Passengers are generally getting heavier and larger. So, ultimately, in the bigger sense, it has to be addressed.
Yes, yes. Well, let's stay with the generously proportioned and have a very quick look at a voluptuous aircraft dubbed the Flying Bum, which has joined a French eco-tourism company.
I'm glad you said that instead of me. it's not a term I'd normally use talking about aviation, but yeah, having seen the images and, you know, the prototype of the Airlander 10, as it's more professionally, more formally termed, this is a very intriguing project because it's basically an airship. And I know the airship has had a checkered history, you know, from like, well, over 100 years ago. But things have moved on. And with the pressure for sustainability, this is a vehicle that has been completely redesigned and re-engineered to fly on helium and electric. So it's more sustainable. It's not the sort of thing you're going to see at an airport, you know, trundling down the runway. it has more of a vertical lift to begin with. And the idea is it flies at much slower rates. The company that is running, it's called Hybrid Air Vehicles, running Airland, has struck a deal with a company called Grands Espaces, which is run by a Pioneer Explorer, to run Arctic tourism flights to difficult-to-reach places to offer incredible views, because you get totally different views and it's a much slower speed to these, you know, inaccessible places.
Right.
So there's definitely a role. I think that's just a fantastic opportunity for aviation, but it still has to go through the certification and the production, and that isn't likely to happen for another year or more.
Sally, thank you very much indeed. That's Sally Gethin there, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
A summer of sport lies ahead, with Paris hosting the Olympic and the Paralympic Games exactly 100 years since the event last took place in the city. Since the dawn of the modern games in 1896, a different city has been showcased every 4 years as the host of the greatest sporting event in the world. Integral to this is the design of the medal, which also varies according to the host. Well, yesterday, the 2024 design was revealed, and each of the 5,084 medals produced will include 18 grams of iron from that most iconic of Paris landmarks, the Eiffel Tower. Tim Abrams is a contributing editor at Architectural Record and joins me to talk about this now. Tim, for the first time, the medals have been designed by a jeweller. Can you tell us more about the collaborative team behind this?
The collaborative team behind it. Well, I think the fact is the French have been spending a great deal of time thinking about how to deal with some of the constraints of this current Olympics. It was executed and won in a climate of austerity. It's also been executed and delivered in a period of, shall we say, rethinking about how we reuse buildings. So this Olympic Games is only going to have one new venue in it, which is almost unprecedented in the history of the Olympic Games. One of the things about the Olympics is it tends to garner its own movement with celebratory architecture. So if you want to win the Olympic Games, you've got to promise to build lots of buildings. And in this case, the French have not promised to build any buildings. In fact, they're only building the aquatic center, which isn't even going to host the swimming. It's just the diving. So what we have in this situation is a decrease in the architectural offering of the Olympics in one ways, but here in the design of the medal, a brilliant way of reintroducing the architectural fabric of the city in a very real and very present way. And I think it's a brilliant idea.
And the Eiffel Tower itself will also be a location for some of the events. How will that work?
Well, this is an area where the French have, the Parisian organisers, look very closely at the English experience with London 2012, and they've taken the lessons learned from the 2012 Games even further. You will remember in London 2012, we had the beach volleyball hosted on Horse Guards Parade. We had temporary structures hosting those. And there was something delightful about the apparent incongruity about being surrounded by the venerable and neoclassical elements of London whilst playing something as groovy and hip as a beach volleyball. And the French have really taken that to heart and expanded that and kind of spread it out across the city, because, as I said, they are reused. They're not building any new buildings, but reusing the existing. And the Olympic, the Eiffel Tower is one such place. But the Le Grand Palais, which was built for the Universal Exposition as the Eiffel Tower was in 1889, that is being used as a key event as well, as is La Concorde and Champ de Mars and Les Invalides. They're being these spaces which we are used to seeing, these very stately Parisian backdrops, will be inhabited by by all manner of different sports, particularly particularly in the centre of Paris.
Tim, thank you very much indeed. That's Tim Abrams there. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Laura Kramer, Chris Chermak and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. Our researcher, Neoma Ekwe, and our studio manager, Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday in London and The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. I'll be with you tomorrow and we'll be speaking about Chinese Lunar New Year and a new artwork by Ai Weiwei. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.